All right, good morning. Well, this is, of course, Christmas time and the Advent season. We're all eagerly anticipating Christmas arriving. Now, my family, what that means is that my children and myself and my wife are looking forward to my homemade cinnamon rolls on Christmas morning. Now, I have to apologize to any of you out there who fancy yourselves cinnamon roll chefs, because I've been informed that mine are the best in the world, so there's no shame in second place, though. You're okay. But let's imagine for a minute with me that this whole pastoring gig thing I'm doing doesn't work out anymore, and I decide that cinnamon rolls are my future, all right? And I decide that I'm going to open up a boutique cinnamon roll bakery shop in downtown Palo Alto. I find the perfect spot, and I figure, you know, if you pay $4 for a cup of coffee, $5 for an ice cream scoop, I can charge $6 for cinnamon rolls, right? So, critics, you know, keep it silent. So I open up my shop. 1 year later, what do you think has happened? That's what the first service said, bankruptcy. You guys have no faith in your pastor's baking skills. We need to work on this. No, in fact, in my imaginary scenario, after 1 year, I am a fabulous success. Thank you very much. In fact, people all across the country are coming to Palo Alto for their cinnamon rolls. There is a cinnamon shortage, so that cinnamon farms all over have to ramp up production because my cinnamon rolls are creating so much demand. This is what's happened. Now, in light of my fabulous success, I make a decision to take the next step. And I'm going to plant a new shop in San Jose. I figure that, you know, college students are in San Jose, they like cinnamon rolls, right? Am I right? Get some nods, okay. So we're going to plant it right by San Jose State, and we go and we build it out. It looks just the same. They use my recipe, and everything's fantastic. It just is a booming success. Of course it would be. But then something happens. I get a call from the manager of my store in San Jose, and she says, you know, things are going great. This is awesome, but we have some ideas. And we think that we could make some changes to the recipe that would make it better. I know, right? I mean, I would be speechless. What changes could there possibly be that would improve upon this? And so now I have to make a decision. How much control do I exert as the original on my little branch shop? What do I do here? How do I respond to these supposed improvements on my recipe? What relationship does the original one have when things start to spread out? And that's the kind of situation we're going to be thinking about this morning. As we return to our series in Acts, we're going to look at the book of Acts, this series we've called Sent, Living the Mission of the Church, and we're seeing how the church began in Jerusalem and how the gospel went out from there to the whole world. We've seen how people have fled from Jerusalem with the message of the gospel. And for the last 2 weeks, we looked at this really significant story that ends up being a turning point in the story of the gospel. Cornelius, a Gentile centurion, is converted. And with that decision, we see God officially validating the spread of the gospel to the Gentiles. Those people, the ones that Jews would not even be allowed to eat with, are now fully included in these communities around Jesus. It's a huge shift. It's unthinkable, but this is what has happened. And so this week, after last week meeting a Gentile convert, now we're going to meet the first Gentile church. In fact, it's the second church of any kind that we've met. Outside of Jerusalem, this is the first time we see a new church forming. And what we're going to notice is that the gospel, which began in Jerusalem, is going to come out. It's going to land in this new place. It's going to do some cool stuff. And then it's going to go back. And it's going to return to where it came from in a different kind of way. We're going to see the boomerang gospel. So our story in the last half of Acts 11 describes the city of Antioch and the new church that gets formed there. It's like a new franchise of this Jesus community thing. What does the gospel do when it creates a new thing? How does it change the people that get wrapped up in this Jesus community? What becomes true of them that wasn't true before? What is kind of the central thing that happens? And what response does it elicit from them? How do they then relate back to where the gospel came from? What's going on in all of this? As we encounter this new community, we're going to learn some important things about the gospel itself, about the priorities of this message. We're going to notice this surprising relationship between Antioch and the mother church in Jerusalem. And I think it's going to give us a model for how to understand what the gospel does in our lives and how the gospel goes out from us. And maybe by the end, we'll have some wisdom for my cinnamon roll dilemma as well. Well, this morning the story begins, as it has for most of Acts, in Jerusalem. That, by the way, is about to shift. But for now, the story begins in Jerusalem with Acts 11, verse 19 through 21. Now, those who were scattered from Jerusalem because of the persecution that arose over Stephen traveled as far as Phoenicia and Cyprus and Antioch, speaking the word to no one except Jews. But there were some of them, men of Cyprus and Cyrene, who on coming to Antioch spoke to the Hellenists also, preaching the Lord Jesus. And the hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number who believed turned to the Lord. So this is, of course, a reference back to Acts 8, where after Stephen was martyred, there arose a great persecution in Jerusalem, which made the disciples flee, made them go out all around the world. Some of them went to various cities, and now the story focuses on one particular city, Antioch. Now we hear that people came to Antioch, and at first they preached only to Jews, and nothing much happened. But then we hear that people came from Cyprus and Cyrene. Notice that Cyprus is an island in the middle of the Mediterranean, and Cyrene is far away on the north coast of Africa. When people came from those cities to Antioch, they had the courage to preach also to Gentiles. And only when that happened was there success. And when that happened, there was great success. The hand of the Lord was with them. A great many people came to faith, and a new church was founded. Now, this isn't exactly the strategy that you might have come up with if you were in Jerusalem figuring out how to spread the gospel. You wouldn't necessarily have people come from these faraway places apart from Jerusalem. You wouldn't necessarily have people try with the Jews and not work and then go to the Gentiles. But this is how the gospel works. And we've seen over and over again in Acts that the gospel doesn't seem to follow the script that we want it to. The gospel spreads in its own ways. So when the church in Jerusalem hears about something happening in Antioch, they do what they've done in the past. Verse 22, the report of this came to the ears of the church in Jerusalem, and they sent Barnabas to Antioch. So presumably they're sending Barnabas to Antioch in order to validate what's going on, to check it out and make sure it's okay. Now Barnabas is an interesting choice for a person to send with this task. The first time we heard about Barnabas in Acts, we heard of him selling all of his possessions and giving them to the early church community in Jerusalem. So he was clearly all in. We also know that Barnabas defended Saul. If you remember, Saul had this dramatic conversion, and he came then to the apostles, and the apostles weren't sure whether to accept him. So Barnabas defended Saul to the apostles, saying, no, this conversion is real. You can trust him. We also know that Barnabas was from Cyprus, so perhaps he knew some of the people that had preached in Antioch. So he was a significant guy in Jerusalem, but he wasn't an apostle. He wasn't a deacon. He had no official title. In fact, the last time that the apostles sent people to check out a new thing, it was Peter and John that were sent, the big guns. And now they're sending this guy, Barnabas. Who is he? And what would he be looking for? He's sent to Antioch to figure out if things are okay. What are the standards that he's going to use? What is he looking for to make sure is there versus some stuff that might not matter? What would you look for? What is core to the gospel? What is the thing that you would look for to make sure is there to know that they've got this whole Jesus thing right? How do you look for that in your own life now? How do you discern the work of God in something from something else? How do you judge the work of God? When my kids were little, my wife stayed home to take care of them. And with little kids, I realized there are 1,000 decisions that you have to make every minute, which is very different than how they train you to have kids, in fact. If you are a parent and you took parenting classes or you read books, you have these kind of case studies of when this happens, you can think about it this way and you could respond that way, and you know, you have lots of time and space to figure out the appropriate response. And then you have actual people that are born to you, and you have to make those decisions immediately, all the time, with no time in between and no time to think about it. And so it turns out this is one of the things I was most surprised about parenting, that it's a constant series of ill-informed, unprepared, spur-of-the-moment, incredibly significant decisions made with little sleep. And in the first service, I apologize to my children for all the mistakes that I probably make and continue to make. But see, my wife was staying home making all these rapid decisions while I, after some time, came to the relative peace and quiet of my job here at PBC. That was when I got to have these, you know, I got to have conversations with adults, spiritually mature adults, about significant things. That's when I was working with college students, not the men's ministry. And so I would have all this space to think about the best way to parent, and then I would come home, and I would hear about these rapid-fire decisions that she made, and of course, I would be critical of them, because, well, didn't you consider the 17 alternatives, and how you could have, if that you did that, what that could have led to that, and come on, how can you not have thought of all this stuff, because, well, there's no time to think of that. But isn't this our tendency with things that we care deeply about? We are critical. We want things to be done a certain way. We know how it ought to be done. We see the right way, and we want it to be done the way it makes sense to us. How do we judge what's really God and what are our own understandings or our own assumptions? How was Barnabas supposed to evaluate these people in Antioch? This is like that moment when my manager of the cinnamon roll shop in San Jose calls me and says, "We want to tweak the recipe." What do you do? How do you understand that? How do you evaluate that decision? Well, let's listen to what Barnabas did. This is verses 23 through 24. When he came and saw the grace of God, he was glad. And he exhorted them all to remain faithful to the Lord with steadfast purpose. For he was a good man, full of the Holy Spirit and of faith. And a great many people were added to the Lord. What Barnabas finds in Antioch is the grace of God. He finds a community that has been changed. Something about them is different. Something smells different about them. Something is in the air that's different. It's the grace of God in their midst. And because of that, he knows that they're okay. Think about how remarkable that is, that he recognizes that immediately. Have you ever had that experience where maybe you visit another church or you're on vacation and you go somewhere else and they sing a song you're familiar with, but they have an extra measure in there, or they sing a chorus you're not familiar with, or they change a word or two, and you just think, don't these people know how God likes his music sung? How could they change what is clearly the right way to sing a song? I mean, people do things differently, and when you're used to one thing, you don't always accept a different style. But here's Barnabas going to Antioch, and he says, I see the grace of God here, and that's enough. That's incredible. He affirms them, everything they're doing. He says, keep doing what you're doing. Stay the course you're on. Don't change a thing. In fact, when we hear about the evaluation, what's evaluated isn't Antioch, it's Barnabas. We're told that he sees this because he is a good man. He's the only person in the entire book of Acts to be described as a good man. We're told he is full of the Holy Spirit and of faith. The only other person to be described that way is Stephen, the martyr. And so Barnabas, because he is a good man, because he's in tune with the Spirit, he's able to see the grace of God and affirm everything that's going on in this new community, even though it most certainly had to have looked different than what he experienced. Now, that's not to say that he decided they had everything right, because he realized this was a young community and they needed teaching. They needed to continue to grow in their development. So he decides he needs help, and he goes to fetch someone that we haven't heard from in a while. Listen to verses 25 and 26. So Barnabas went to Tarsus to look for Saul. And when he had found him, he brought him to Antioch. For a whole year they met with the church and taught a great many people. And in Antioch, the disciples were first called Christians. If you remember, Saul was the Jewish leader who had begun as the worst enemy of the church, hunting down Christians to imprison them. But he had this dramatic conversion. He came to faith, and immediately he started preaching the gospel, but his first attempts were pretty disastrous. Chaos ensued. And so the apostles at Jerusalem said, Saul, we love you, but we would love you more if you were a long way away. So they put him on a boat and sent him to Tarsus, and then things got back to normal, and the gospel continued to bear fruit in Jerusalem. That was 12 years ago from the scene we've had here. Saul has been safely tucked away. Things have been going great. So why does Barnabas think what this church needs is Saul? What would lead him to think that? Why Saul? Why now? We don't know what Barnabas was thinking, but we do know it was a good decision. Turned out that this is what would launch Saul into what became the most famous and fruitful missionary career ever. And so Barnabas goes to get Saul, and they spend a year preaching in Antioch, teaching them about Jesus, working through the scriptures with them. And we are told that in Antioch, the disciples were first called Christians. Now, this doesn't necessarily seem like a big deal. We know the word Christians. It's just a descriptive word. People use it all the time. But this is the first time we hear about it. And in fact, it's a rare term in the New Testament. People who follow Jesus are only referred to as Christians three times in the New Testament. And in all those cases, it seems to be a reference to outsiders calling those who follow Jesus by a certain term. In fact, some people think it was probably meant as a derogatory term. The word itself is a Greek construct word that's used, made by taking a name like Christ and adding a suffix to it, which essentially indicates you're a fan of that person or a follower of that person, or you live in such a way as to emulate that person. So it'd be like they're calling these people little Christs. Think about that. The gospel comes to Antioch, creates a community of people who follow Jesus. And the people around them that don't follow Jesus look at them and say, those people seem like they're trying to act like that Jesus guy. They seem to live their life emulating Christ. We should call them Christians as a descriptive term. Wow. That's pretty cool, right? For the people around this church to recognize that and to label them in such a way that they are little Christs. In fact, I would like nothing more than for us to be labeled that way. For the people around us to look at our lives, to look at our community, the way we live, and to say, those are the people that are trying to be like Jesus, aren't they? But in fact, that's not exactly how people often refer to us. How do people in our culture refer to those who follow Jesus? Yell out some labels that we are given. What do people call us? Out loud. Fanatics, yeah. What else? Intolerant. Prejudiced. Judgmental. Publican. Republican. Yeah. I just said publican at first. I was like, really? Oh, Republican. Yep. Bible thumpers. That one came up in the first service too. Yeah. Self-righteous. Bigots. Yeah. The interesting thing is that people apply those kinds of labels to Christians, but generally not to Jesus. If you talk to people about what they think of Jesus, they'll say, oh, he was a great guy. That Jesus guy, he preached love. He, you know, upended things. But the people that follow him, they don't seem like him at all. What would it look like? What would it be like for us to be labeled by outsiders, people who look like Jesus? How could we be known as little Christs? What if we were perceived that way? What if people noticed that, you know, those who follow Jesus tend to put others' needs above their own? You know, when there's something that comes up at work and there's an opportunity to get ahead, they seem to champion other people. They don't promote their own achievements. They ask to point out other people's accomplishments. Maybe they even pass up opportunities for the sake of others. They care about life passionately. They seem to care about all kinds of life. They care about the life of the unborn, even when that's unpopular. They care about the uneducated, the uniformed, the underprivileged, and the undocumented. They welcome anybody who's different from their midst, from the foreigner or the outsider to the orphan and the widow. They even talk to that awkward guy at work that everybody avoids. These people seem to have strong ethics about sexuality and marriage. They believe and they practice things, but they don't demonize other people who think differently. They stand up for unfair treatment when women are treated unfairly, or seniors, or children, or minorities. They care about everybody. In fact, they don't even seem to stay in their political lanes. They don't just vote party. They seem to get everybody mad by loving everybody. It's just like that Jesus guy. He did the same thing, and they killed him. Boy, we should call those people Christians, because they're like little Christs in the world. Wouldn't that be amazing if that's what people thought of us? Isn't it amazing that this young church in Antioch so quickly took in the gospel, received this message, and their lives were transformed so that that's how they were perceived? How can we be like them? These guys are amazing. But it only gets better. The church really shines in the last part of the story. Listen to verses 27 to 28. Now in those days, prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch, and one of them named Agabus stood up and foretold by the Spirit that there would be a great famine over all the world. This took place in the days of Claudius. Now traveling prophets were common in the ancient world. It was kind of their version of Twitter. So this is how you would know what was going on in other parts of the world. Prophets would come and they would give information, and then those would get reprofited around to, you know, other areas. And so you would kind of learn of events all across the empire. So Agabus comes down and he tells of a famine that's going to hit all over the entire world. Now we actually know of this famine from other historical records. A year prior, we know of a flood year in Egypt around the Nile. And what would happen is that when the Nile would flood, the crops around Egypt wouldn't grow as well. They would get flooded, and that would drive the price of grain way up because there would be less supply, which would then cause people to hoard, and then would have all sorts of problems all around the region because Egypt was such a central supplier. Over the course of a year or so, this would cause great famine. The ancient historian Josephus actually describes around this time the price of grain doubling in a year. But famine didn't hit everyone equally in the ancient world. In fact, a historian from 1935 says it this way: in the ancient world, famine was always essentially a class famine, and it turned on the price of grain. The poor and improvident lacked reserves of money and food and suffered immediately when prices rose, while the rich had reserves of both and seldom went hungry. Though the rich might experience economic discomfort, it was the lower classes who suffered actual hunger and starvation. Now, this is actually true of us today as well. If, for instance, the price of groceries in Palo Alto doubled over the next year, There would be a lot of people who would say, boy, that's really inconvenient. That's really a bummer. I'll have to spend more on my food. There would be another class of people that would actually not be able to purchase food, that would actually starve, perhaps even to death, because they couldn't afford food. This is the hard truth of economic hard times. It doesn't hit a community fairly. It targets people with fewer resources. When the water rises, the people who are barely keeping their head above water drown, while others get their pants a little more wet. So this famine is going to hit the ancient world, and Antioch hears about it, and they know that the most vulnerable people are the people with the fewest resources. Now, it's likely that they're among that class, because for the most part in the ancient world, the people that were drawn to the message of Jesus were those people who were vulnerable, who were the lower classes. So they probably know that they're going to be hit particularly hard by this crisis. And that's what makes it so incredible what their response is. Listen to verses 29 to 30. So the disciples determined everyone according to his ability to send relief to the brothers living in Judea. And they did so, sending it to the elders by the hand of Barnabas and Saul. So this new community decides, every one of them, according to how much they can afford, to make a collection and send it back to Jerusalem to care for the poor who will be hardest hit by the famine there. Think about what they're doing. This is a branch church. They had been formed from the mothership, from Jerusalem. And when a crisis hits, you might expect them to write back to Jerusalem and say, hey, we're going to have some hard times. We need some help. But they don't do that. They make a collection of themselves, and they send it to help the mothership. It's not exactly what you would expect unless you understand what the gospel does to a group of people. The gospel is not like a secret recipe for cinnamon rolls that has to be closely guarded and that starts in the center and always goes back and it's integrally connected. The gospel releases people. It creates equals. It creates partners. It creates communities with their own visions for the work of God among them. The church at large is not a centralized command and control structure where everything is tightly regulated. It isn't a franchise where every little outpost has to look exactly like the ones that came before. The church is more like an orchard that sprouts forth from one tree, whose fruit goes forth and plants new trees, each one looking different as it gets further away and developing in its own way because they're all unique. The gospel has come to Antioch from Jerusalem. It has changed people. It has created this community. And now the gospel goes back from Antioch to Jerusalem in the form of aid, resources, material help. The gospel has become a boomerang. The same is true for us. The gospel comes to us. It changes us. We learn something of Jesus. We profess faith in him, our lives become changed, and then the gospel goes out from us in ways we might never have predicted, because God's work is always that way. How do you send what you have received? How have you been transformed from a recipient of the gospel to a sender? It's time for a history lesson, all right? So in the course of a few centuries, it's interesting to note that Antioch would become one of the most central places in the ancient world in terms of churches. So the Patriarch of Antioch, that's the Orthodox term for kind of a network of churches, that patriarch would be the largest in the Christian world by the 4th century. We've learned our history, now it's time for our vocabulary, all right? It's also interesting to note that Cyprus, the church that sent people to Antioch, was the first church in the 5th century to become, they were granted what's called autocephaly. Autocephaly. Can you say that word with me? Autocephaly. This is not a brain disease. It's not something that will eat away your skin. Autocephaly is a religious term to indicate that they were now an independent church. They did not have to do what the archbishop in Antioch said. they actually had their own archbishop and did whatever they wanted. They became autocephalous. They became independent. And it's interesting to think a little bit about how the development of the Roman Catholic Church differed from the development of the Eastern Orthodox Church. So the Roman Catholic Church tended to develop as a centralized command and control structure. Everything went back to Rome. Rome was the center, and Rome controlled the whole network. The Orthodox Church, on the other hand, developed where each little outpost became relatively independent. They developed their own patriarchs, and they had their own customs and their own ways of doing things. Now, you're wondering why all of this is important. It's important because I think we tend to gravitate towards that centralized command and control structure. If we start something, we think, well, we have a right to make sure it happens exactly the way we think it should happen everywhere it goes. And if we didn't start something, if we receive something, we tend to think, well, I can't really do anything unless I ask permission. I got to figure out who's in charge of me, and then I can ask that person permission to do whatever it is I think might need to be done. But when we realize that the gospel doesn't work that way, that the gospel creates communities that are all autocephalous, that are all independent, that in fact each of you are autocephalous, that you have the work of God in you, you realize that God can do incredible things in incredible and surprising ways through all of us. That we send out what we have received. When a crisis strikes, what do you do? How do you release what you have? How do you observe things? You don't have to ask permission. You have the Spirit of God in you. You have the gospel message. If you are a follower of Jesus, then you have Christ in you. You are a little Christ, regardless of whether you're perceived as one. And Christ can work through you in ways that might be totally different from how Christ has worked in other people. What does that look like for you? How is the Spirit leading you? The gospel has come. You have received something. How will you send that out? Well, let's wrap up by coming back to my cinnamon roll dilemma. Having understood this principle of the gospel, how might I now respond to my manager in San Jose who wants to change the recipe? Maybe I'll say, well, maybe that's a good idea. Maybe you've figured out something unique about people that live in your area where you could actually change it for the better. Someone from the first service helped me come up with a business plan that allowed me to maintain some control but give some autonomy as well. So maybe there's a balance, you know? If you have any ideas, you can let me know after the service. But the gospel in our story this morning has shown us how it creates these communities of independence, how it goes forth, how the gospel changes people into representatives of Jesus, and how that then goes forth in surprising ways. By way of conclusion, let's think one more different thing. Think about Jerusalem. And think about how they felt. The gospel went forth from them. They were the senders. The gospel got to Antioch, a largely Gentile city. A Gentile church sprang up. And when a crisis came up, they wanted to help Jerusalem. How would you feel if you were one of the apostles in Jerusalem, the original hearers of the gospel? You walked with Jesus. And now these Gentiles want to write a check to help you. You might not be so thrilled to accept that, except that you've been changed by Jesus too. And you realize that we are all partners, that just because you have sent something doesn't mean you don't need also to receive something. And so we are senders, we are sent, and we are receivers. There are things we need to receive. We don't have it figured out, even though we send people out. Maybe we need to learn from people who have different experiences of Jesus. Maybe we need to learn from other churches or other believers. We are senders. We are receivers. We are all partners in this gospel movement with anybody who professes Jesus as the Christ. May we learn to live this mission of the church, and may the world see Christ in us. Amen.